This is Father Watson. The title of this program is America's Invisible Government and Its Government's Secret Agenda, Number One. Let us say a prayer. This is Psalm 65 in the Douay Rheims Bible. Shout with joy to God, all the earth. Sing ye a psalm in his name. Give glory to his praise. Say unto God, how terrible are thy works, O Lord. Let all the earth adore thee and sing to thee. Let it sing a psalm to thy name. Come and see the works of God, who is terrible in his counsels over the sons of men. O bless our God, ye Gentiles, and make the voice of his praise to be heard, who hath set my soul to live, and hath not suffered my feet to be moved. Psalm 65, verses 1 to 9. The government of the United States was much better in the years after the establishment of the Constitutional Republic in 1783 than it is now. It can be said that the American government began to deteriorate from the very beginning, and that because a movement to alter it radically and to reinterpret the Constitution was in motion from the time that it was ratified. This movement can be referred to as federalism, whose main purpose was to concentrate political power in the federal government at the expense of the states. The reinterpretation of the Constitution has been an irresistible drive to change our republic into a democracy, for democracies are properly named mobocracies, whose majorities can easily be manipulated to their own undoing. The original concept had the vote of the people's representatives in the Congress balanced and checked by the vote of the states in the Senate. The 17th Amendment did away with this arrangement. The Founding Fathers were unanimous in two things, namely that they did not want to establish a monarchy, and even more strongly, did they labor to avoid establishing a democracy. By the time of the Civil War, the difference which manifested itself between the Federalists of the North and the Anti-Federalists of the South had developed into a tragic and destructive fracture. No matter what one may say about the issue of slavery, there can be no doubt that the Confederate States had the Constitution on their side. In declaring war upon the Confederate States, the Federalists violated the Constitution profoundly, and in the Reconstruction they carried their disdain for state sovereignty to its logical conclusion. Since that time, they have used one pretext after another, civil rights, wars, environmentalism, education, the war on crime, the war on drugs, and on, to diminish the independence and negate the sovereignty of all the states for the sake of empowering and enlarging the federal government. Toward the end of the 19th century, a new virus became manifest, and that was world federalism. This movement gained force throughout the 20th century. Interestingly, the chief proponents and agents of the enterprise are the ideological and, in many cases, the biological descendants of the Federalists, America's perennial subversives. Not content to have gained almost totalitarian control over this country, they are bent, in concert with similar-minded individuals in England and around the world, on world dominion. For Hitler to aspire to rule the world was an intolerable atrocity. For them to do so is manifest destiny. Speaking to the House of Lords on March 2, 1770, William Pitt observed that there is something behind the throne greater than the king himself. The next century, another British statesman, Benjamin Disraeli, expressed a similar sentiment when he wrote in his novel Coningsby, or The New Generation, quotations, The world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes, close quotations. Here in the United States, this power behind the throne is most often referred to as the establishment, and its most significant front organization is the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR. From the ranks of this establishment powerhouse come the captains and kings of government, business, and finance. Democratic President Bill Clinton is a member, as is former Republican Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich. Until Congressman Gingrich's resignation, he and Clinton pretended to be at loggerheads on domestic policy, but never on foreign policy. The CFR's members are the nearest thing we have to a ruling establishment, Washington Post columnist Richard Harwood confessed in the paper's October 30, 1993 edition. This is not a retinue of people who look like America, but they very definitely look like the people who, for more than half a century, have managed our international affairs and military-industrial complex, wrote Harwood. He should know. The Post's principal owner, Catherine Graham, and several of the editors are also members of this exclusive establishment club. Yet the Council on Foreign Relations is hardly a household name. Anyone who condemns its awesome power runs the risk of being branded as a right-wing extremist. In this series of programs, we shall make an effort to examine not only the power behind the throne, but its objectives and modus operandi. We identify its ultimate objective as the creation of a totalitarian one-world government, oftentimes euphemistically referred to by the insiders themselves, not to mention other internationalists, as a new world order. That objective, of course, is not shared by the vast majority of the American people, and for that very reason, the plotters must obfuscate their global designs. We dare call this plotting, by many of the world's rich and powerful, a conspiracy. To be sure, the CFR itself is not the conspiracy, and the members of the CFR are not all New World Orderites. Yet in the shadows, behind the CFR and other powerful internationalist groupings, such as the Trilateral Commission, behind the giant tax-exempt foundations, behind the Wall Street and Federal Reserve financial and banking interests, behind presidents and prime ministers, behind the NAFTA, GATT, WTO, IMF, NATO, UE, UN axis, behind even the communist menace itself, is the conspiracy for global control. Is what we're saying here an outlandish notion? Is this more right-wing paranoia, which so wrinkles the brows of leftist pundits and commentators? The major media mavens would certainly like you to think so. And to help implant such thinking, they have even attempted to lump together responsible critics of the New World Order with virulent racists who burn black churches and armed terrorists who blow up federal buildings, some of whom they have employed themselves. They have gone so far as to warn darkly of a vast right-wing conspiracy that must be reckoned with through the imposition of illegal police state measures and the suppression of some of our hard-won liberties. But to say that there exists a global conspiracy to destroy freedom and to consolidate all power into the hands of a relative few, we will not hear such a thing. Yet in spite of the establishment line, a conspiracy for global control does exist, and the evidence demonstrating the existence of that conspiracy is both plentiful and convincing. Part of that evidence will be presented in this series of programs. Many observers of our national decline resist the notion of a conspiracy in high places because they want to believe the best of our leaders. But if the fix is in, the only way to reverse course is to expose that unpleasant reality. We ask that you, dear listener, receive the material given here, to weigh the evidence, and to judge for yourself. If you decide that we are right, and we are absolutely convinced that we are, then we hope you will also become involved to expose and oppose the conspiratorial designs. We hope you will do so, in fact, as if your life and freedom depend upon it, because they surely do. The Communist Party of the United States has had an agreement with the Mafia since 1924, with the arrival in the United States of Ennio Sarmenti, alias Vidali Contreras Victorio. Upon his arrival, he reestablished the understanding between the Mafia and the Communists that was made in Italy by Bordiga, a leader of the Italian Communist Party, and by Ercole Palmieri Togliatti, alias Ercole. The agreement called for the Mafia to do work for the Communist International, such as murdering opponents, distributing counterfeit currency and dope, stealing government documents such as seals and stamps for foreign passports, and other jobs which Communist agents could not carry out, but which the Mafia and its connections could. According to General Major Jan Sejna of Communist Czechoslovakia, one of the highest-ranking defectors ever from the Soviet bloc, the Kremlin launched a major global effort in the 1950s the more thoroughly to penetrate organized crime in all countries. As told in Red Cocaine by Dr. Joseph Douglas, General Sejna explained the plan. The Soviets reasoned that if they could successfully infiltrate organized crime, they would have unusually good possibilities to control many politicians and would have access to the best information on drugs, money, weapons, and corruption of many kinds. A second reason was to use organized crime as a covert mechanism for distributing drugs. Working hand in hand, these two globe-straddling conspiracies wield enormous power. But this convergence of criminal interests and cooperation does not alone begin to explain the incredible totalitarian communist advances during the decades after World War II. The Communists were relentlessly carrying out their comprehensive plan for a global conquest, as detailed in the program of the Communist International, adopted at its 6th Congress in Moscow, September 1, 1928. But incredibly, they were also advancing their diabolical design with indispensable help from the capitalist West. More and more Americans began coming to the realization in the 1950s that the advances of communism abroad and socialism at home had more to do with policies and programs emanating from New York and Washington than from Moscow. It was the vast transfusion of Western technology and money taken from American taxpayers that's time after time saved communism from collapse. It was repeated betrayals by American diplomats, bureaucrats, and politicians that turned scores of nations and hundreds of millions of souls over to brutal tyranny. It was American officials who time after time appointed communists and communist sympathizers to sensitive government posts and then fought their removal when they were discovered. It was many of America's top financiers, bankers, and industrialists who were arranging loans and financial aid to the Kremlin. informed Americans became alarmed at the key role that several of the large tax-exempt foundations, Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie, particularly, had been playing in providing funds to individuals and organizations identified with communism and socialism. Even worse, some of the foundations had communists and subversives on their staffs and boards of directors, one of the most egregious examples being the appointment of notorious Soviet spy Alger Hiss to head the Carnegie Endowment. In 1952, the United States House of Representatives established a formal committee to investigate the foundations. In 1953, the committee's top researcher, Norman Dodd, visited the New York City headquarters of the Ford Foundation at the invitation of Ford President H. Rowan Gaither. At that meeting, Dodd later recounted, Gaither brazenly told him that he and others who had worked for the State Department and other federal agencies had for years operated under directives issued by the White House, the substance of which was to the effect that we should make every effort so to alter life in the United States as to make possible a comfortable merger with the Soviet Union. It was growing obvious to many that that was exactly the course which our government was following. Dr. Bella Dodd, a former member of the National Committee of the Communist Party USA, who left the party and became a committed anti-communist, recounted that on occasion, top orders from the party came not from Moscow, but from any one of three designated men at the Waldorf Towers in New York, all of whom were extremely wealthy American capitalists. I think the communist conspiracy is merely a branch of a much bigger conspiracy, said Dr. Dodd. I would certainly like to find out who is really running things. An important clue concerning who is really running things was revealed in 1966 when Professor Carol Quigley of Georgetown University published his massive history, Tragedy and Hope. Professor Quigley, who had access to the secret records of the international network of moneyed power elitists who have formed much of our government policies for decades, averred that this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. That same year, Robert Welch published his important essay entitled The Truth in Time. In it, he stated that the communist movement is only a tool of the total conspiracy and pointed to the West as the real seat of the conspiracy's power. It is our intention to present the truth of the conspiracy and the conspirators and their goals, strategy, and tactics in the hope that a sufficient number of Americans can be awakened and moved to proper action in time. Writing in the July 17, 1926 issue of the Saturday Evening Post, author Arthur D. Howden Smith presented a profile of an enigmatic man named Colonel Edward Mandel House. Although few Americans beyond the rarefied realms of the political elite knew much of House, the austere Texan had played a decisive role in many of the most important policy decisions made by President Woodrow Wilson. On more than one occasion, Wilson described House as his silent partner, his second personality, his independent self. Although this friendship would later disintegrate under the stress of political disappointment, during the 8 years of the Wilson administration, the president maintained of House that his thoughts and mine are one. Smith recounted that during and after World War I, House and Wilson had dreamed great dreams of modeling civilization anew. dreams that would collide abruptly with reality when the Senate refused to approve U.S. enrollment in the League of Nations. Following this defeat, Smith records, House returned from Paris to New York, heartbroken, disappointed, in despair over the failure of his ambition to make this country the balance wheel of a new world order. House had long entertained notions of remolding America and the world nearer to his heart's desire. According to Smith's admiring biography, House believed that the Constitution, a product of 18th-century minds and a quasi-classical medieval conception of republics, was thoroughly outdated, that the country would be better off if the Constitution could be scrapped and rewritten. This ambition inspired House's 1912 novel, Philip Drew, Administrator, in which an idealistic Marxist conducts a coup and installs socialist reforms by dictatorial decree. We need not remark that Philip Drew sounds very much like a prototype of him who now resides in the White House. Mandel House described the novel as an expression of my ethical and political faith. Thus, this is of some moment that the book's hero seeks to establish socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx, embellished with a spiritual leavening. Among the most cherished reforms envisioned in Philip Drew is the creation of a League of Nations, the term specifically used by House in his novel, and the submergence of the United States into a world government. When in real life the League of Nations were thwarted by the United States Senate, House and his colleagues found it necessary to continue their struggle by other means. House was part of a cabal called the Inquiry, a group of 100 forward-looking social engineers who created the Versailles Peace Treaty at the close of World War I. This group formed the nucleus of the Institute of International Affairs, which was to have branches in New York and London, the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, and the Royal Institute of International Affairs, respectively. This is the basis of the Anglophile network described by historian Carol Quigley in his 1966 book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Although Quigley offered in Tragedy and Hope the expectable dismissals of conspiracy theories, he did offer some significant admissions. There does exist, and has existed for a generation, an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. Both Tragedy and Hope and Quigley's much more important posthumous study, The Anglo-American Establishment, are available to everyone who has a serious interest in these contentions. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Round Table Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. Quotations, "I know of the operations of this network," wrote Quigley, "because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records." The roundtable groups, which were semi-secret discussion and lobbying groups, were created to help federate the English-speaking world along lines laid down by Cecil Rhodes. The American affiliate of this network, Quigley continued, was known as the Council on Foreign Relations. Although he did not endorse all of that network's designs or decisions, Quigley was generally supportive of its ends, stating that, "My chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known." It was this network, according to Quigley, that provided much of the framework of influence which the communist sympathizers and fellow travelers took over in the United States in the 1930s. It must be recognized that the power of these energetic left-wingers was never their own power or communist power, but was ultimately the power of the international financial coterie. Quigley noted that the workings of this elite were partially revealed by congressional investigators in the 1950s, who followed backward to their source the threads which led from admitted communists like Whitaker Chambers through Alger Hiss and the Carnegie Endowment to Thomas Lamont and the Morgan Bank, fell into the whole complicated network of the interlocking tax-exempt foundations. The subversive network of interlocking tax-exempt foundations through which the moneyed elite has funded the efforts of energetic left-wingers is a fulfillment of one of Mandel House's Philip Drew prophecies. Quotations, "It will be the educated and rich, in fact the ones that are now the most selfish, that will be in the vanguard of the procession. They will be the first to realize the joy of it all, that is, of constructing world socialism, and in this way they will redeem the sins of their ancestors." Of course, that redemption is to be accomplished by seizing total power in the name of social justice, world stability, or some other grand abstraction. And that seizure will be paid for by the money, liberty, and lives of the less fortunate, those whom Karl Marx labeled the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Although Carol Quigley enjoyed unique access to the formal records of the Anglophile network, he is not the only academic who has documented its existence and methods. In a study entitled The Power Elite, published 40 years ago, Columbia University sociologist C. Wright Mills sought to dismiss the conspiracy theory of modern political history, even as he vindicated the essential claims of the conspiratorial perspective. Although Mills claimed to find no conspirators in high places, he nonetheless admitted, quotations, "There's little doubt that the American power elite, which contains, we are told, some of the greatest organizers in the world, has planned and plotted." He recognized the existence of a definable network joining elitists in politics, academia, the military, the media, and foundations, and admitted certain types of men from each of the dominant institutional areas, more far-sighted than others, have actively promoted the liaison before it took its truly modern shape. While many elements of this network are visible and identifiable, according to Mills, the power elite is not altogether surfaced. Many higher events that would reveal the working of the power elite can be withheld from public knowledge under the guise of secrecy. With the wide secrecy covering their operations and decisions, the power elite can mask their intentions, operations, and further consolidation.